Oh, we give thanks for this precious day, for all gathered here and those far away, for this time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day, for all gathered here and those far away, for this time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day.
Welcome all. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Dave Lambert, and I will be this morning's convener. We of the UUFM share a commitment to shared humanity and to common values, so that wherever you come from, whoever you came with, whatever you believe, please know that you are surrounded in this community by fellow seekers who share your belief of a shared humanity and a belief in common values. Although our seven guiding beliefs are written on the back of the program, we do have one common theme. We stand on the side of love. So normally I have a couple of volunteers in the front row to light the chalice, but they're gone today, so I won't light the chalice. As is traditional by Unitarian Universalist Fellowships around the country, we open our service this morning with the lighting of the chalice. And as we sing our songs of common community, let us remember that we are part of a great community of love. I'm going back and forth on the regular program and the one I put together. So please stand as you are able and join me in singing in the Teal Hymnal, hymn number 1018. Come and go with me.
Come and go with me to the land.
please share with those in this caring community a short personal joy or concern that is significant in your life. And I will take a bit of prerogative here, as you wait for the microphone to speak into, to give thoughts to Dick Biebman, who is under the surgeon's knife tomorrow. Dick and Sylvia, neither of them are here this morning that I can see. So please keep both of them in your thoughts and your prayers for tomorrow, and hope for a speedy recovery for Dick. Other joys and concerns?
Hi, Linda Krieger. I have a joy in that we have a new foster son, Jess Finkmeyer, who is living with us, and I hope you all will have a chance to get to know him. He's a great kid. Thanks.
I'm Roger Johnson. I have one sibling who is exactly 3 years and 2 days younger than I am. But she's a medical miracle. When she was a year and a half old, she was diagnosed with infant onset diabetes and nearly died. In fact, my parents didn't think she'd make it to be 18. Well, she graduated from college. She became a teacher. She got married. She had two daughters. And now she has 7 grandchildren. Well, the concern that I have is that about a week ago, they found her unconscious in her apartment and, of course, rushed her to the hospital. The doctors, from what I can tell, are fairly optimistic that she will recover, but she hasn't spoken a word since she was taken to the hospital. But her eyes have followed people around the room, and one of my nieces has made the point of telling her that I've inquired about her and wish her the best. And my niece says that she can tell that my sister is responding very positively to that. So it's a concern that I have.
I'm Marion Quinlan, and I wrote this out because I was afraid I might break up reading, coming up there and saying it. I wanted to thank you all and express my gratitude to all of you who responded to my need, and as requested by Chris Renner. Your time and effort will always be remembered and greatly appreciated. Special thanks to Christopher for organizing all of you, and to Anne Cowan for opening her heart and her home to me to visit while I'm here. I really appreciate all that you've done and all the support that you've given me. Thank you.
Christopher Renner, I have two things. First of all, I want to really express the joy I felt yesterday seeing a bunch of UUs in Topeka in front of the State Capitol building. We were well represented yesterday, and it was a pleasure to be part of an international gathering of people who are saying no to the agenda of hate. It just was phenomenal. The other thing is, I want to give a little report on Sam Lacey, our longtime member, our 97-year-old member of this congregation. Sam is doing well. He continues to improve at the rehab center. There was some discussion about maybe coming home in a couple of weeks. So if any of you are out that way and want to stop in and see him, please do so. He greatly appreciates having people come by. I would encourage you to encourage him to get up and walk around a bit. Just go for a little walk, okay? This is a concerted effort on the part of physical therapy and myself to get him out of bed as much as possible and get up and moving. He is 97, after all. The more moving he does, the better it is, okay? So he's doing well, and once again, if you can get out and see him, thanks.
My dog Chance died today. Yesterday, we went to my dad's pet store and got my pet snake.
Mm. My name's Keaton, and I got my pump a few days ago.
You want to tell them what it is?
It's my diabetes pump. It pumps insulin.
Could you hear it?
No.
He got his diabetes pump a few days ago.
And I like the hat.
Huh?
I like the hat.
Oh, he likes the hat.
John Extell, the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice held an anti-inauguration party Friday night, and lots of people were there on 70, and we had a great time. So we are now motivated to move forward on that on many issues.
Okay, although they may be unspoken, we hold the joys and concerns of all of the others of you in this fellowship close to our hearts as they are to you. I do have an announcement to make. Most of them are written on the order of service that you've all received as you came in this morning. But tomorrow, the Chipotle is having a fundraiser, donating half of their proceeds to the homeless student program. So if you happen to be at Chipotle's tomorrow, you might point out to them that tomorrow they're donating half of their profits to the homeless student program. Are there other announcements that Kathleen? Okay. We now would like to recognize the OWL graduates, and I'm going to turn this over to John Liu.
Okay. We have a celebration today. Since way back in the fall, 7 youth, 6 from our fellowship and 1 from First Congregational Church, have been immersed in Our Whole Lives, OWL we call it, the curriculum that was jointly developed by the Unitarian Universalist Association and the United Church of Christ to help relate information about sex and sexuality to our values. OWL teaches students about making good choices, about relationships, and about respect for self and others, as well as learning factual information. They learn that healthy sexual relationships are consensual, non-exploitative, mutually pleasurable, safe, developmentally appropriate, and respectful. One of their units included a panel of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people who were recruited from the university. And the panelists told me how impressed they were with our youth, with their questions, and with their insight. And what's more, they were impressed with our program, that we expend the time, money, and commitment to be sure that our youth are prepared for some of the most important decisions they will make in their lives. They wished they had had something like it. There are several different units of OWL appropriate for different ages, and the one that these youth have completed is the most comprehensive and time-consuming one, so they've really accomplished something. And actually, most of these youth have been through 3 levels of OWL, so they are experts. Today, we acknowledge their accomplishments. What's more, we're here to acknowledge this program and all that we did to make it possible for them. Molly tells me that it's been 30 years since we did this level of OWL. So we also want to thank the trained volunteer teachers who made it happen, Molly McGoy and Matt Campbell and Jen Campbell. Why don't you all just stand up and give some love? And so I invite them to take it from here.
Sorry, I have to get a little bit organized, and it will all seem disorganized. So, okay. All right. So, over here. So, a thank you note and a little gift for Matt, and a thank you note and a little gift for Jen, and I get one too. I wasn't left out. But we're going to call the students up in a minute. But this is our moment to shine. I told them that this was our victory lap, so you have to forgive us a little bit. So, thank you to John Alou, and we want to share a couple numbers with you. So we had two parent sessions, three trained facilitators, 25 workshops in the curriculum, and about 36 class hours to do those workshops. And when we add it all up, the training, the prep, the teaching, and everything else, that's about 500 person hours of focused effort. Now, half of that's the adults. The other half is the kids. So the kids, when we added up all their time together, they shared a lot of time with us on Sunday afternoons, and we want to thank you for showing up and for sharing of yourselves, because it's a big commitment, so thank you. Adolescent sexuality is often approached by assuming a young person will fall somewhere on a negative spectrum. At one end of that spectrum is an unwilling victim, and at the other end of that spectrum is a willful risk-taking. And there's no healthy place on this spectrum, and there is no assumption of power or agency for young people on this spectrum. Social science researchers are catching up with our whole lives. A recent scholarly article described our whole lives as emancipatory sexuality education. For our kids out there, this means freedom. Our whole lives education frees young people to be the best whole people they can be. The parents who sign up their sons and daughters know that they will gain knowledge, but even more importantly, they will gain confidence. They are free to be themselves. So, I'm going to call each of the kids up one by one, and Matt and Jen are going to help me hand stuff out. Thank you. All right, so in no particular order, Clara Mayfield, Maeve Tenona, Lily Colburn, Indigo Bellinger, Helen Mayfield, looks like we have a light showing today, Mia Thompson, and Dean Kinderknecht. Anyone? Okay, we've got three of our seven. Thank you to those who show up. Okay, so each participant is getting a certificate of completion, and they asked me if they had to speak, and no, we didn't make them speak. Each participant is getting a little certificate of completion, an owl keychain that they can carry with them when they go about their lives, and we also wanted to include some kind of advice or affirmation, so Jen found this message, and it's tucked in a card in your little bags there. So, you are amazing. I'm going to cry. As you are. Stronger than you know, worthier than you believe, more loved than you can imagine, passionate about making a difference, fiery when protecting those you love, learning, growing, not alone, flawed, whole, scared, brave, and so, so much more. Be confident, be you. So, that's our advice. And at this time, I am declaring a group hug, and you can all clap for us.
So, one final set of thanks to Molly and Matt and Jen and to Sandy Nelson for coordinating and making it all happen, and to the parents of the youth, because they really make a commitment to this too, and to the youth themselves for their work. Thank you so much to everybody.
Michael, do you want to? Michael will now call up the chorus.
Anthem. The one we had planned required quite a few more singers than were able to make it to the church today. But it's a nice piece. You'll like it too. And this sentiment is not too far from "Don't You Let Nobody Turn You Around."
Oh, I woke up this morning with my mind.
This morning's story for all ages will be led by Jessica Sievers, and Jessica will take over the program, and all the kids can come up and sit closer to her if they'd like.
All right, have a seat. I have a book today about someone very special. His name, does anybody know his name? Yes. Shout it out. Martin Luther King Jr. Actually, it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He has a very, very familiar face, I think. So this book is called Martin's Big Words, The Life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. by Doreen Rappaport. And I really like the illustrations. Yes, do you have a question? You've read this in the class. Okay, well, don't give away the ending. Everywhere in Martin's hometown, he saw signs that said white only. His mother said these signs were in all southern cities and towns in the United States. Every time Martin read the words, he felt bad. Until he remembered what his mother told him. You are as good as anyone else. In church, Martin sang hymns. We do that too. He read from the Bible. He listened to his father preach. Those words made him feel good. When I grow up, I'm going to get big words too. Martin grew up. He became a minister like his father, but he used the big words. And he used the big words he had heard as a child from his parents and from the Bible. Everyone can be great. He studied the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. He learned how the Indian nation won freedom without ever firing a gun. Martin said love when others said hate. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. He said together when every other said separate. He said peace when others said war. Sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together. In 1955, on a cold December day in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks was coming home from work. A white man told her to get up from her seat on the bus so he could sit. She said no and was arrested. Montgomery's black citizens learned of her arrest. It made them angry. They decided not to ride the buses until they could sit anywhere they wanted. For 381 days. Think about that. How long is a year? 365. So this was longer than a year. They walked to work and school and church. They walked in rain, and they walked in cold and in blistering heat. Martin walked with them and talked with them and sang with them and prayed with them until the white city leaders had to agree they could sit anywhere they wanted. When the history books are written, someone will say, there lived black people who had the courage to stand up for their rights. In the next 10 years, black Americans all over the South protested for equal rights. Martin walked with them and talked with them, sang with them and prayed with them. White ministers told them to stop. Mayors and governors and police chiefs and judges ordered them to stop. But they kept on marching. Wait! For years I have heard the word wait. We have waited more than 345 years for our rights. They were jailed and beaten and murdered, but they kept on marching. Some Black Americans wanted to fight with their fists, and Martin convinced them not to by reminding them of the power of love. Love is the key to the problems of our world. Many white Southerners hated and feared Martin's words. A few threatened to kill him and his family. His house was bombed. His brother's house was bombed, but he refused to stop. Remember, if I am stopped, this movement will not be stopped, because God is with this movement. The marches continued. More and more Americans listened to Martin's words. He shared his dreams and filled them with hope. I have a dream. Does that sound familiar? That one day in Alabama, little Black boys and little Black girls will join hands with little white girls and little white boys as sisters and brothers. After 10 years of protest, the lawmakers in Washington voted to end segregation. The white-only signs in the South came down. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. cared about all Americans. He cared about people all over the world, and people all over the world admired him. In 1964, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was like 30 years old. Like, I'm 30. I feel like that's like way too young to be getting such an honor. He worked so hard. He won it because he taught others to fight with words and not fists. I think he was actually closer to 40, but we won't worry about that. Martin went wherever people needed help. In April 1968, he went to Memphis, Tennessee. He went to help garbage collectors who were on strike. He walked with them and talked with them, sang with them and prayed with them. On his second day there, he was shot and he died. His big words are alive for us today. Something to think about when you go off to your classes. Shall we sing them out?
We have reached the point of the offertory, and please be generous in sharing with those in this community so that we can continue our good works. Please join us in the singing of hymn number 168, One More Step. Stand as you are able. This morning's introduction to John Lu's reflection is loosely taken from the UUA website, People So Bold. Prophets are consistent voices for justice. They call on everyone, from kings to peasants, from presidents to citizens, to change their ways and align their actions with the Most High, Most Loving, and most just values of society. But the prophets don't just speak. They live their values, often at considerable risk. They are able to read the signs of their times and lead their listeners in creating justice. A prophetic church is on the cutting edge, reading the signs of its times, creating a just and loving community in its midst, and advocating passionately for a better world. I recall Paul Simon's words from the mid-1960s. The words of the prophets are written on the subway walls and tenement halls. Yesterday, as Chris already mentioned, the words of the prophets were also written in the hearts and on the signs of millions of people around the world who rose up to announce and proclaim their higher selves. So please, John Lu.
Many years ago, when I was interviewed by the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, the body that decides who can become a UU minister, one of its members asked me what the source of my commitment to social justice was. And without hesitation, I answered, the Hebrew prophets, which surprised me because I hadn't really put that together until that moment. Those who have gone before have been a great influence. Now, a couple of weeks ago, in this prophecy theme, I regaled you with some stories of ancient prophets, not all from the Hebrew tradition, John the Baptist, Cassandra of Troy, Jonah. This morning, we turn our attention to current circumstances. Let me remind you of the words of the progressive Hebrew Scriptures scholar Walter Brueggemann. The task of prophetic ministry is to nurture, nourish, and evoke a consciousness and perception alternative to the consciousness and perception of the dominant culture around us. Many of us are unhappy with the dominant culture around us and what it sees and believes, its perception and consciousness, in Brueggemann's words. As you use, we notice many problems in the dominant culture. Increasing inequality between the rich and poor, corruption of our democracy through moneyed interests, racial injustice, the persistence of sexism and heterosexism, violence and wars, to name just a few. We grieve when we see suffering people, and we long to find a way to salve their misery and prevent future pain. As UU theologian Paul Raiser put it, religious liberals affirm a vision of a more just society and a religious obligation to speak out against and work to overcome conditions that interfere with fulfilling this vision. We've been doing this since John Sigismund of Transylvania issued the first edict of religious toleration in 1568, since the middle of the 19th century when Theodore Parker wrote his sermons with a gun by his side to protect the fugitive slaves he was housing, since our Beacon Press published the Pentagon Papers in the midst of the Vietnam War, since Hillary Goodridge and others sued the state of Massachusetts for marriage equality. And yesterday, a bunch of us joined our 4,000 closest friends marching in Topeka for women's rights and more. Who was there? I was there. Good. There were a bunch of us there. Perhaps not everyone agrees that a march is the way to usher in a better world, but our principles and prophets do call us to take action. Here are the words of Peter Morales, president of the UUA. This is not about partisan politics. It is a principled response to the potential targeting of people not for what they have done, but for who they are. It is a commitment to speak out and to act in support of basic human rights. In each of the examples that I named, each of the examples of action I named, right up to showing up yesterday, Unitarians have been or have followed prophets with a vision to make the world better and then applied themselves in earnest to make it happen. We've always wanted and still want an alternative proposal, a vision of the world that's not what most folks project, a vision that doesn't allow people to fall through the justice and mercy gaps, that strives for an end to war and for food, education, and health care for every child. Imagine. The prophet sees something others don't see. Imagines a future that others cannot envision. Man, we could use big doses of that right now. Because though many people gathered up in many places yesterday, we have to do more than show up to change the world. We need ideas, we need inspiration, we need strategy. In short, we need prophets. Fortunately, we have people who have been imagining, not always UUs, because we don't look to our own religious tradition exclusively. One of the sources of our living tradition is the words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. And those prophetic people are not always those who have gone before. There are people alive today who I would call contemporary prophets. Listening to them and learning to recognize them can help us see things in a new way and help us achieve what we thought was impossible. I want to share a few examples with you this morning, just examples. I'll probably not include your favorite prophet. That's not the point here. The point is to seek out prophets and learn from them. So my goal this morning is to talk about a few and describe how what they are doing qualifies as a prophetic vision. They imagine far and wide in various contexts, but as they look at the future, They've not always imagined something good. Today's prophet, who's most in tune with the old image of the prophet as the declarer of doom, may well be Bill McKibben. He started out as staff writer at the New Yorker, writing the Talk of the Town column during the 1980s, and he left to become a freelancer, and somewhere along the way, his prophetic voice awakened around climate change. His book, The End of Nature, in 1989, translated scientific observations into reports and predictions that lay people could understand. And ever since, that has been the topic he has embraced and written on, given his life to. And writing wasn't enough for Bill McKibben. Since 2007, he's been organizing actions. Step It Up, a project to push Congress to recognize the dangers of global warming, and 350.org, a group committed to the idea that carbon dioxide concentrations of more than 350 parts per million in the atmosphere are disastrous. Our current levels are close to 405, which tells us that the devastating effects of climate change are no longer in the future, but are happening right now. And here are some of McKibben's words from a book whose title tells us we no longer live on the same planet we were born on, Earth, with an extra A, making a life on a tough new planet. The planet we inhabit has a finite number of huge physical features. Virtually all of them seem to be changing rapidly. The Arctic ice cap is melting, and the great glacier above Greenland is thinning, both with disconcerting and unexpected speed. The oceans, which cover 3/4 of the ocean's surface, are distinctly more acid, and their level is rising. They are also warmer, which means the greatest storms on our planet, hurricanes and cyclones, have become more powerful. The vast inland glaciers in the Andes and Himalayas and the giant snowpack of the American West are melting very fast. And within a decade, the supply of water to the billions of people living downstream may dwindle. The great rainforest of the Amazon is drying on its margins and threatened at its source. The great boreal forest of North America is dying in a matter of years. The great storehouses of oil beneath the Earth's crust are now more empty than full. Every one of these things is completely unprecedented in the 10,000 years of human civilization. And some places, with civilizations that date back thousands of years, like the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, are actively preparing to lower their flags and evacuate their territory. We have traveled to a new planet, propelled on a burst of carbon dioxide. That new planet, as is often the case in science fiction, looks more or less like our own, but clearly isn't. And the attempt to make it right usually makes things worse. That's life on our new planet. That's where we live now. Those are not the kind of dire warnings you wanted to hear this morning. You already knew things are bad. I don't want to make it worse. I do want to make a case for calling Bill McKibben a prophet and point out something that he does. He looks around at the current conditions, names them clearly, slamming us with more statistics and anecdotes than we can fully absorb. And as he does, he also looks forward and says, if we continue as we are, here's what it looks like will happen. As time moves along and more of the predictions come true, more and more of us can see what he's saying. And then we say, oh, the prophet. He ends his horror story of a book with these words. But we will keep fighting in the hope that we can limit that damage. And in the process, we'll help build the architecture for the world that comes next. Earth, with an extra A, represents the deepest of human failures. But we still must live on the world we've created, lightly, carefully, gracefully. Hopefully, we listen and hear in time to manage some of those changes. Another prophet, Michelle Alexander, an African-American legal scholar, warns us about the necessity of some more manageable changes. She doesn't have the stacks of books and articles about her issue that McKibben does, but just as his book, The End of Nature, introduced the concept of climate change to many of us, so Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, changed the conversation about criminal justice, and especially its intersection with race. There were things I already knew when I read that book, that race was a factor in the death penalty, that blacks were incarcerated in higher proportions than whites for drug offenses, that police pulled blacks over at higher rates than they did whites. What shifted for me was the recognition that these and other factors were so embedded in the system that the issue was not so much criminal justice as racial injustice. Alexander convinced me that the legislative and policing changes that created this situation were deliberate in their use of racially coded language, and that the justice system has been used to perpetuate racial discrimination because it was no longer legal to discriminate solely on the basis of race. As Alexander wrote, most Americans know and don't know the truth about mass incarceration. Know and don't know the truth. In other words, she named clearly evident truths that remained hidden until she pointed them out, because we, especially those of us who are white, didn't want to see them. 10 printings later, that is the role of the prophet. She changed the conversation. Another woman whose prophecy has inspired me, and she is barely a woman, is Malala Yousafzai. Malala's story is well known, how she spoke out for education for girls in Afghanistan, was shot by the Taliban, and lived to receive a Nobel Peace Prize. As with everyone's story, there is more. Malala was named after a legendary heroine of her people, the daughter of a shepherd whose words rallied the soldiers of her people to defeat the British army. And that Malalai died in the battle. She sacrificed herself to achieve the end. And today's Malala absorbed the story of her namesake and understood sacrifice. As she agitated for the right of girls to attend school in Taliban territory, she realized she was risking her life. Long before she was shot, she recognized the danger of a lonely flight of stairs. She imagined a terrorist confronting her and her saying to him, "Okay, shoot me, but first listen to me. What you are doing is wrong. I'm not against you personally. I just want every girl to go to school." People might be skeptical about a young girl with such forcefulness and commitment to ideals. Her parents, her father, surely they must have pushed her to this. Well, he did name her after a martyr. But I know how passionate and composed a young woman can be when challenged. The preteen daughter of a lesbian couple attended the congregation I served in Madison, Wisconsin. And her witness for LGBTQ rights was the most pure, grounded, and heartfelt I have ever heard. When she testified before a legislative committee, a local ministerial colleague turned to me and asked, "Is she for real?" "Absolutely," I said, "that is her. Yes, her parents supported and coached, but the passion, the commitment, the words, all her. A prophet can come from very unexpected places and situations." And that's what I think about Malala. She continued to push. She continues to push for the right to education in the Middle East, in Africa, wherever the right's under threat. And though shot, she continues to dedicate herself to a vision of education and equality of opportunity for girls. That is a prophet's heart. For prophets are often persecuted, shot, driven from their homelands. But they do not stop. She knows and perseveres. Sometimes the persecution of prophets is only mockery and dismissal. But often, as with Malala and others, the threat is graver. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. Trained in the 1980s in New York, Ai uses a variety of genres and media, from photography to performance, from sculpture to Twitter. He may be best known for his bird's nest design for the 2008 Olympic Games, a project he now regrets as a piece of propaganda for China. The size of his ideas distinguishes him from other artists. He thinks on a huge scale. Sunflower Seeds, which is one of his most well-known works, includes 100 million pieces of porcelain painted by 1,600 Chinese craftsmen. Each piece looks like a sunflower seed. That's the scale he thinks on. So why does China imprison and restrict its most famous contemporary artist? Because he continually speaks out against the wrongs done by the state. Take, for example, his work around the 2008 earthquakes that killed more than 5,000 Chinese children, in part because their schools had been structurally unsound. I forced the government to own up to what happened as he published the list of the victims. And later, he built this sculpture memorial that he called Straight, and its steel beams that were taken from the devastated schools and straightened out and piled. The Chinese government does not like its mistakes publicized or turned into art. Ai repeatedly finds his blogs shut down, cannot travel without permission, has been beaten, arrested, and had his studio destroyed. He has suffered like a prophet because he declares what he sees happening around him without fear of the consequences. He's particularly interesting because, unlike others I've named today, he has delved into multiple issues and concerns rather than having a single-minded focus. So the prophets I've named, and many others, come mostly from outside the political world, though they touch that world from time to time with their explorations. We could talk about comics like Jon Stewart and Samantha Bee, food activists like Michael Pollan, organizers like Grace Lee Boggs. I want to end, though, with a religious man, a Disciples of Christ minister whose organizing work has changed the game in North Carolina and is spreading across the country, including to Kansas. William J. Barber II. An African-American minister in North Carolina started Moral Mondays, regular gatherings of citizens to confront the state legislature about moral issues they were voting on. Now, we might think, oh no, a minister talking to legislators about moral issues. Don't worry, it's okay, this is good. Resisting the divide and conquer status quo, he convinced people of different races, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, and immigration status to join together in what he calls fusion politics to bring about change. Barber followed his father into ministry, but felt a calling to change the conditions under which people live, not to accommodate them to those conditions. Working from a base as NAACP president, he built relationships across North Carolina. He listened to the stories, and he applied the four-part methodology touted by both Gandhi and King. Gather the facts. Try to negotiate with the authorities. And if they refuse to negotiate or negotiate in bad faith, it's time to up the ante and prepare, or in his words, engage in self-purification. This is a stage of teaching people how to use nonviolence and examine their willingness to suffer. What are you willing to bring to the cause? And finally, the fourth step is direct action, civil disobedience. So many have credited Barber and Moral Mondays for creating the circumstances where the North Carolina governor was tossed out this past election day, the first time that a sitting North Carolina governor was defeated since 1976, when governors were first able to run for a second consecutive term. Now, that's big. And if you follow North Carolina politics at all, you know the fight isn't over. But the approach is spreading to Georgia, South Carolina, Illinois, New Mexico, and as I'll elaborate in a minute, even here in Kansas. Barber's approach, a prophetic approach, takes morality seriously. It dares to name right and wrong. It is wrong to discriminate against people. It is wrong to keep them from voting. It is right to feed and educate children. He insists that every budget is a moral document or an immoral one. Our priorities in government demonstrate our values. We cannot call ourselves good and allow our government to be amoral. Sounds like one of those Hebrew prophets in many ways, because this moral grounding and insistence on naming right and wrong are part of the prophetic voice. I will mention that Christopher Renner is co-facilitating a citywide common read of Barber's book, The Third Reconstruction, so that might be something you want to check out. 10 days ago, 15 of us from this fellowship, who was at the Kansas People's Agenda? There were people, yeah. So 15 of us from this fellowship, along with several hundred others from around the state, showed up at the state capitol to invite our legislature to consider a Kansas People's Agenda. Those organizing the Kansas People's Agenda were drawing on Barber's idea, an example of fusion politics, pulling together people across various interests and issues, black people, white people, native people, Muslim people, immigrant people, Christian people, Jewish people, UU people, there were plenty of UUs there, gay and lesbian people, trans people, cis and straight people, all gathered together knowing that the people united will not be defeated. We had specific ideas on our agenda like funding public education, taxing workers fairly, access to health care, a justice system that treats people of color fairly, ethics and transparency in government, environmental stewardship and sustainable agriculture, equal pay for equal work, voting rights without unjust burdens, freedom from discrimination for BGLTQ people, responsible gun policy, religious freedom, protections for immigrants, reform of the criminal justice system, government investment in the road, rail, and water systems, and protection of children. I hate that it's a long laundry list of things, but that frankly do not feel very radical to me at all. These are sensible, reasonable expectations of a government concerned about its people. And as Barber suggests, they are moral expectations. Yet, we, the people, have to insist that our legislators, Democrats and Republicans alike, listen to sensible, reasonable, moral expectations. And they will not do it unless we insist. Here are words from William Barber. In this season, when some want to harden and stop the heart of our democracy, we are being called, like our foremothers and fathers, to be the moral defibrillators of our time. We must shock this nation with the power of love. We must shock this nation with the power of mercy. We must shock this nation and fight for justice for all. We can't give up on the heart of democracy. Not now, not ever. The words of the prophet. We have about 5 minutes if there is anybody who wants to nominate a prophet or share their thoughts on contemporary prophets with us.
Jim Chanteau. I didn't get a chance to hear him when he was here, but I heard what he said when it was written out. Bill Nye, the science guy, mm-hmm. Had a surprising reason for, I guess, being a prophet. And he said, remember what happened to the dinosaurs? Gigantic meteor hit, wiped out, you know, hundreds of millions of years of development of dinosaurs. Is anybody watching for meteors? Turns out we had one pass last year, not that far from Earth. Nobody saw it. Mm-hmm. That's a prophecy that's coming way away from us, and nobody's checking.
It's Pat Embers. this whole idea of prophecy is, I think, inherent in the Native American tradition. And what has really astounded me is, I can't name one, but the whole representation of Native peace and justice and nonviolence from the prophecies of their traditions is evident in Standing Rock. And even though I followed the traditions for, you know, a long time, I was amazed at how universal it was, drawing people from all over. So I feel the prophecy there, and I feel that there is more than one person that is speaking up as a prophet there.
Gene Severs. I've had a great deal of respect for Harry Belafonte and his life and beliefs and statements. Got a chance to hear him at K-State when he was here not too long ago. Somehow I was hoping that President Obama would draw from sort of his influence and thoughts, and that possibly didn't happen because of how severe Belafonte's criticism of George W. was, but a very impressive individual.
Hello, Jess Finkmeyer, her foster son. The last name of the person that I'm thinking of is slipping my mind, but her name is Annette. Oh, never mind. Annette Hope Billings. She's a Kansas writer and poet, and recently I got to see some of her work and her speak it in person. She is a lesbian African-American woman, and she speaks out about all of the injustices verbatim of those things. And seeing her and seeing her work and being able to talk with her left like a permanent and amazing mark on me and really like brought me up to kind of be like the person that I am and to outspeak that way. So, yeah.
I think one of the people who has influenced me very much because of her prophetic stance is Sister Simone Campbell from the Nuns on the Bus. Some of you are familiar with that group. Starting several years ago, they made trips around the country in a large bus. One of the places was in Topeka. And in their travels, they talked about social justice issues and had some instructional time with people and brought people up to date on some of the needs in society before they moved on to another town. I forget how many trips they did, at least two, possibly three. Mm-hmm. And they've had quite a bit of influence, and I think they're admirable people.
Yeah, she was here last year.
Well,
thank you. I just about didn't get that. well, I want to nominate Wesley Jackson for the prophet who's been most important to me. And I heard this comment that made me think of my dad, who said a lot of times, a prophet is without honor in his own time and land. Wes has commented on how much he knows about how disliked he is in Salina, Kansas, and what a badge of honor it is to be in that position.
Okay, I'll just remind you then of these words from Barber. We can't give up on the heart of our democracy, not now, not ever. Our closing hymn is number 298, Wake Now My Senses. Please stand as you are willing and able. Words of Tony Vincent, justice makes tireless demands, and we grow weary. As we touch one another in common cause and with the great spirit in our midst, let us find the way and the courage to realize the dream which still lives within us. So may it be. I'll remind you we're having Path to Membership in here in about 15 minutes, so please go in the other room and have coffee in the Alsop room.